Okay, folks, welcome once again. This is Elvin Shamroth here. We're doing our fourth, teleseminar of the year every 2 weeks. And as is the case throughout the year, we get new people joining in. And for that purpose, I'm just going to briefly share with you how this works. We, for the first time, have someone who has volunteered a case that they have a concern over, and it's really very helpful. I'll go into that in a moment, why so. But what we do, I mute everyone out, because if you have 100 people talking with all the background noise, no one will hear a word. So I've muted everyone out except myself and our active participant, and we're going to discuss the case that he presented. And the case that he presented actually has some very important things that we can discuss that's valuable to every single person listening in. So it's really a good case, and I think you folks are going to find this very helpful. You will notice as the teleconference winds its way through that I don't mention the last name, so you don't need to be embarrassed in case I ask you a question and you don't know the answer in front of dozens and dozens of your colleagues. You will remain anonymous. And also, I want to encourage you folks to volunteer, because it's really excellent experience. All of you need to get as much experience talking about your cases and defending your decisions as much as you can, because that's really the nature of the exam. You can say and do, you can do in clinical practice anything you want, pretty much. But as long as you can give a reasonable explanation why you did what you did, that's all they want to see. And yeah, you may have some bad outcomes, but that's okay. As long as you did the appropriate thing and what was reasonable, that's what they're listening out for. So this is a real golden opportunity for you folks to get that kind of exposure, and I encourage you all to volunteer on the hot seat and submit some cases that you've got. And all of you have cases you're a little worried about, you're not sure how to present, how to defend. So please, I encourage you to submit them for discussion, and we can discuss them at this teleseminar. I will also share with you, as I mentioned, that this is the first time this year that someone has submitted a case, I guess it was a warning. It wasn't intended that way, but I shared with you folks 2 weeks ago that if no one submitted a case, I was going to draw back on the frequency with which we're doing these teleconferences, because it's not as valuable to you folks. And we only got this case submitted a couple of hours ago. So up until a couple of hours ago, we were only going to have the next teleseminar in 4 weeks' time. But since we've got this one now, we will have a teleseminar as the next one, as usual, in 2 weeks' time. And again, I want to use this opportunity to encourage all of you to volunteer. It's free. Free is good. And I really want to encourage you to participate in an active form. So with that out of the way, I want to go through where our active participant today. The name is Avis. Avis, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi there. And Avis, thank you so much for submitting your case. It's very nice of you. I know it's a little anxiety generating, but you'll notice this will be it'll go smooth and easy, and I'm very confident you'll feel it was very well worthwhile. So Avis, what I want to do is I've got the email that you submitted to us. I've got that in front of me, but for the sake of everyone listening in, I'd like you to just simply present the case in a succinct fashion, And then you can share with me, I think I know what your issues are. You can share with all of us what your concerns might be, and then we'll talk about it. But why don't we start with you presenting the case?
Yes, so I had a 25 years old, this is an OB case. I have a 25 years old G1P0, 40 weeks, 2 days on presentation to the labor and delivery. She presented with pre-labored rupture of membranes for 24 hours. We started the induction of labor. Regarding to her antepartum history, she had a long-sustained mildly elevated blood pressures, and GBS was negative. Otherwise, her antepartum was pretty uncomplicated. And during the induction of labor, she developed category 2 fetal heart tracing and also maternal fever with elevated white blood cells. There was also fetal tachycardia, and we treated as a chorioamnionitis and then with antibiotics. And later on, there was no progressions in her labor, and we scheduled an emergency primary C-section for her due to the chorioamnionitis and removed from the delivery. During the delivery, baby was actually coded with an APGAR score 1, 0, and 1. Baby measured about 2,900 grams, and mom the patients actually had 1,000 milliliters postpartum hemorrhage, which was successfully treated with uterotonic tonic and transanamic TXA. Mom stayed in the hospitals for 4 days, and the baby actually required active resuscitation and neonatal cooling and stayed in the hospital for 7 days.
Okay, very good. There are a lot of issues I want to discuss with you and everyone listening in, and for that reason, this is a wonderful case. Let me ask you, I think I know the answer to the question I'm going to pose, but what is your concern regarding this case?
Yeah, I just wanted to give you a background history about. I work in a very big group, and then I basically just did this C-section section when I arrived at the labor and delivery after the shift change. So I didn't really actively manage this labor, but I came to deliver this baby, which was coded during the surgery and developed a very a poor baby outcome. And my concern is definitely probably there might be some questions about the intrapartum management of chorioamnionitis and tattoo tracing, and also if there are any predictive factors for the poor baby outcome.
That's 100% consistent with what were the issues that I was considering. And folks, listen to what transpired here. Avis basically came in at the very end on what turned out to be a bad situation. A baby that was almost dead upon delivery. APGARs, I think you said, were 1, 0, and 1 at 10 minutes. That's not a good prognosis. And now if you did the delivery, and you have to defend the management, and you're not sure how to do that. So that is a major part, and we need to address that. There are, however, a lot of other more minor things that warrant talking about. So, Avis, I'm just going to list, based on what you said, I'm going to list topics, and you tell me if you think there's a chance that these issues might come up in the discussion around this case, okay? So the first one is the differential diagnosis, workup, and treatment of hypertension in pregnancy. Do you think that's a possibility for you in this case?
Yes.
Okay, good. Next one, GBS screening and treatment. Do you think that's a possible question for you in this case?
That if that's the case, it will be a pretty straightforward question, and but I think
I'm not getting into the complexity yet of each discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just listing the different discussions that you are potentially exposed to. So, given the way you've written this up and you mentioned GBS negative, do you think GBS is a discussion that might come up?
Yes.
Okay, I agree with you. That's two topics. Three, can you get a conversation on PROM and PPROM?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Can you get a conversation going on induction of labor?
Yes.
Sure, that's number four. What about a conversation on the diagnosis and treatment of chorioamnionitis?
Yes, definitely.
Five, yeah. And the diagnosis and treatment of category 2 and 3 tracings. Is that a possibility?
Yes.
So I think we're up to 6 now. PPH, is that a possibility?
PPH, yes.
Yes. Okay, that's 7. Now, folks, to all of you who are listening in, there's a purpose why I'm going through this case like this with Avis, and it really is relevant. The concept of what I'm doing is relevant to everyone listening in. So please don't sign off in your head and just think this is not relevant for me. You'll see where we're going with this. So we've got 7 potential topics. The eighth topic could be emergency versus urgent C-section, yes?
Yes.
Okay, that's 8. You've mentioned on paper neonatal cooling. Do you think that's a possibility? Yes?
Yes.
No, I would disagree with you, it's not. This is not a pediatric exam, okay?
Mm.
You understand? I will, I'll just share with you right now briefly. What is the extent, to all intents and purposes, of the amount of neonatology or pediatrics that you folks need to know in an OBGYN board exam? It's the following. How do you calculate an APGAR score? Okay, the details, how do you get that score? And what are the features, the neonatal features of severe preterm labor? It's IVH, NEC, sepsis, jaundice, RDF, that kind of stuff, okay? And that's pretty much all the pediatrics that we need to know. So the fact that this baby had to undergo neonatal cooling, the examiner's not going to get his or her excitement or jazzed up over that because they don't know much about it themselves because we don't need to know that. So that's really not a potential conversation. And then we've already discussed PPH management. And the final question is, again, on APGAR scores, which are really relevant for you. Now, again, APGAR scores you need to know because your APGARs were 1, 0, and 1. Any of you who have an APGAR score of 5 or less, maybe 6 or less, at 5 minutes or beyond, this pertains to you. So for you, Avis, you need to know APGAR score not because you had neonatal cooling, but because you had intrinsically lousy APGARs at birth. Okay. So you notice there are 8 or 9 topics, discussions that you can have in this case, and there's no way the examiner is going to dedicate one case to have 9 discussions, each one of which will take 30 to 60 seconds. Yeah, because then they're going to spend 7-8 minutes on one case, and then they're not going to do that. So with that in mind, you need to realize you've got a lot of discussions which you can have on this case. And you've got to decide which ones are relevant, which ones are irrelevant, and get the irrelevant ones off the cases because it doesn't make a difference. You keep in mind, at the back of your head, you want to make it, A, easy for your examiner to read your case list, so don't give extraneous information. And number two, you want the information that you do put down to be such that it triggers certain thoughts and read, when I say thoughts, read questions. It triggers certain questions and discussions in the examiner's mind, and you'd be amazed at how effective you can be based on how you write up a case, how you can get the examiner to ask you the kind of questions that you want. It's really not that difficult at all. So the first thing I would say in this case that we all heard Avis present, I would remove the neonatal cooling because it's just a waste of paper, space. It tires your examiner of reading stuff that's irrelevant, and there's no way they're going to ask you about it. So I would remove that. Now, of the remaining eight or so topics, they're not going to ask you all eight. They may ask you two, three, or four. So with that in mind, on any given case, if you've got more than two, three, or four topics or discussions, potential discussions in a given case, remove them if you can. Oftentimes you can. Sometimes you can't. But let's go through those topics that we can potentially remove and see what you think. There's no question that you should not remove. Indeed, you need to have it on your case list, and furthermore, you actually want to have this on your case list. The Category 2 tracing and the lousy APGAR scores, we don't have a choice in that. You've got to put APGAR scores down. So the Category 2 tracing must go on. Would you agree with that, Avis?
Yes, because those are relatively severe questions too.
Correct. And to help you in that discussion, I think the mention of chorioamnionitis needs to go down on paper as well. Would you agree with that? Because that's going to be the support of the Category 2 tracing, yes?
Yes.
And similarly, the support for the chorioamnionitis, the PROM greater than 24 hours with induction, that needs to go down as well because of the support, the basis for the chorioamnionitis. Would you agree?
Agree.
Okay. So those things I think you need to keep. Let's look at mm-hmm. some of the other things. You wrote down on paper, because folks, in Avis's email to me, she gave me the page as it appears on her case list. So I'm looking at what you wrote down. You wrote down GBS negative. If you wrote down GBS negative, why didn't you write down rubella positive, RH positive, urine mm-hmm. CNS clear, all the prenatal labs, all the normal and negative labs? Why didn't you write all of them down? You see my point. It's to be expected. It doesn't stand out. So GBS negative, I would take off. I have no doubt you'd probably like to have a GBS conversation in the exam, but I've got no doubt that there are other patients on your case list where you can get that GBS conversation going, patients where they were GBS positive. But this is not the case to try and get that conversation going. Does that make sense to you? You've got more important other issues to discuss than GBS, given the fact that she's GBS negative. Fair enough?
Yeah, it's fair enough. But I put it in just because she developed like a chorioamnionitis with a poor baby outcome. So I'm thinking GBS status is one of the predictive factors for the chorioamnionitis, and also like...
But she was GBS negative. Well, it's far better. Yeah. You know what would come across better in the exam? is if rather than putting down GV as negative on paper, to just say, you know, when I was suspecting that she had chorioamnionitis, and this comes out verbally, I looked to see again what her GBS status was, because perhaps she was GBS positive, and this might have been an underlying cause, but in fact she was GBS negative. When you say that, it comes across much, much better, because it shows the examiner, I'm thinking clinically and practically how to handle this. And when I get a case of chorio, I'm looking at the differential. So GBS comes up in that context. But it's not a positive finding. It's when you've got a normal or negative finding, but you feel it's important, I'm going to generalize and say better to mention that verbally than put it down on paper. Especially in this case, we've got so many other discussion points where you have to narrow it down. You understand? I'm not going to say you're wrong, but I would just say what I'm suggesting is preferred. That's the way I would put it. Okay?
Yes, I got you.
I would take off GBS negative. Then you wrote, I think you misspelled. You said non-sustained.
Yeah,
I think you meant to say non-sustained. Non-sustained mildly elevated blood pressures. Was that relevant to this case?
No.
In retrospect, no. And it's you. I have no doubt you've got other cases of preeclampsia and gestational hypertension, maybe HELLP, etc. You're going to get that hypertension conversation going on some other case. But this is so inconsequential to what's really going on in this case that I would remove it completely. It doesn't. Well, let me ask you, do you think, and be honest, do you think it adds to the case, Avis, or would the case be stand just as well on its own if you omitted that piece?
Yeah, it's the same, even if I skip the description. Yeah. So should I just put like a dash there or like a uncomplicated in the antepartum column?
Just I'll say your question again. Should you put what in the antepartum column?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, should I just keep it blank or I should just write down something?
Oh, blank. Yeah. No, leave it blank. Because there's nothing of major import. Please, for everyone listening in, don't think that you have to put something down in every column. Because you're going to land up putting stuff, as Avis has done in this case, putting down stuff which, in my opinion, is not relevant. And it's going to leave the examiner with a conscious or at least subconscious thought that you don't know what's relevant and not relevant in this case. And you don't want them to think that. So if there's nothing valid to say, then don't say anything. Keep it short and to the point. What I say, many of you have already, I'm sure, attended my cases construction course. What I say there is let the words that you put down on your case list, that you write down in the list, let that be the skeleton, the bare-bone skeleton, and let the meat be what you say verbally in the exam to explain and provide context for the skeleton. Does that make sense to you, Avis?
Yes.
Okay. So we've already cleaned this up a lot. There's one more thing I want to mention. You wrote down non-massive PPH, and verbally you said it was 1,000 cc's. Okay? Why did you put down the words non-massive? You're just sweeping the carpet from under your feet. You're telling the examiner this was an inconsequential PPH and it was no issue. I'm not suggesting, never will you hear me say that you should be dishonest. And I'm not suggesting you should be dishonest now. But why put the words down non-massive? Just say PPH. Let the examiner think it was a decent-sized PPH, okay? But don't minimize your own abilities. So remove the words non-massive and just put down PPH. Okay?
Okay. Yeah.
And then in the postpartum column, you've got Utrotonix and Thromboxane, TXA. I'm sure, yeah, TXA is Thromboxane, correct? That's what you had in mind?
TXA is the tranexamic acid.
Tranexamic acid. Okay, forgive me, I'm wrong. I wasn't thinking there. Tranexamic acid, my apologies. Okay, so what I encourage you folks to do, and this is true for antibiotics as well, anything where there's a choice of meds that you can give, I advise candidates to be a little bit more vague, purposefully vague. I would, because if you are specific and given all the information, you've left yourself nothing to say in the exam because it's all written down on paper. So I would rather you write Utrotonix and leave it at that. Let the examiner ask you which ones did you give and why and how, rather than putting it down already on paper. You understand? Be word poor. So instead of saying Utrotonix and TXA, tranexamic acid, you say Utrotonix. I also recommend being even more vague. Instead of saying Utrotonix, consider saying medical PPH RX treatment. Okay?
Mm.
Medical PPH treatment. Because when the examiner reads medical PPH treatment, Avis, let's pretend you're the examiner for a moment, and you read medical PPH treatment, what are you going to ask the candidate? What's your next question?
What do you mean by medical postpartum hemorrhage treatment?
There you go. There you go. And you're just salivating at the thought of being asked that question because you're ready to roll with that question. You see how you can write it down in such a way that you pique your examiner's curiosity. And in trying to solve the curiosity, they ask you the very question you're looking for, which is exactly what you did now. So that you understand the psychology of it.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm not trying to belittle the examinant that you can play with their minds. It's not the case. They're intelligent people. But what I am saying is they're human beings just like you and I. And if you and I have our curiosity piqued, we're going to delve a little into that to find out what happened. Okay? So just use that issue to your advantage. Okay? So we've narrowed down tremendously what's important, what's not important. We've gotten rid of what's not important. And we've even gone one step further to word certain issues in a way that's more likely to generate the kind of questions you want to get. You with me so far, Avis?
Yes. It makes sense.
Okay.
It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So now, and only now, we've been chatting for 20 minutes or so, now we can discuss finally the real issue that you're concerned about. And that is, you delivered a patient by emergency C-section who had a clinical diagnosis of chorioamnionitis, and you got a really flat baby that sounds like it was lucky to survive, or some might argue unlucky to survive. It depends how this baby does. But how are you going to defend that?
Right.
And I think here you need to be very explicit. You need to convey on paper, because what's on paper is a legal document. You need to show on paper that this occurred. prior to you coming on to take care of this patient's management. Okay, so how do we do this? I would write. First of all, let me just ask you, Avis, did your you came on at 8 o'clock or so and did an emergency C-section? Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Did you make the diagnosis of chorio, or did your colleague make the diagnosis of chorio?
Yes, my coworker made the diagnosis. I stepped in after the shift change, and then I just immediately went to the OR to do the C-section.
Okay. We have to put down on paper somehow that you acted immediately upon taking control of this patient's care. So how do we do that?
Mm-hmm.
You can write emergency primary C-section in parenthesis upon assuming patient care. Add those four words in parenthesis. How does that sound?
Yeah, that sounds
then
perfect.
You're telling the examiner, listen, then you're not saying there was mismanagement. There might have been, but listen, this kind of thing can happen to anyone.
Yeah.
The question, the discussion really revolves around, and you need to try and do as best as you can for this. Know that that tracing, what that category tracing looked like, and if you can't recall or don't have access to the actual tracing, don't worry about being able to refer to the specific tracing, but be able to talk in general terms. And folks, this is for all of you. Be able to talk in general terms what a category 2 tracing looks like, and what are your options for management? Okay, so you've got to be prepared for that conversation. But if you say emergency C-section upon assuming management, the rest, that's all you need to say, and the rest comes verbally in the exam, and you explain what happened. Now, I need to tell you, and everyone listening in, this is really important. Let's assume for argument's sake that Avis's colleague did, in fact, screw up, okay? I'm just playing the devil's advocate here. Let's say he or she did screw up. How do you handle the situation in the exam? You can say, I think the patient could have been handled a little differently, but you can't leave it at that. You mustn't throw your colleague under the bus, because it really is not professional.
Right.
I would say, let's assume, for example, and folks, all of you listening in, you can extrapolate this general principle that I'm going to give you to your situation, because it's the same principle. You might say, you know, I'm obviously with the very poor outcome, I look back in detail at this case, and you know, I had the advantage of hindsight, but I do think that there was enough indication, and the response to intrauterine resuscitation was such that perhaps this C-section could have been done earlier, or should have been done earlier, and it may have resulted in a better APGAR. I don't know. I will say, and you add this, I will say my colleague that was managing this patient is actually very good, and I don't mean to be cast dispersions on my colleague, but I think if I look at the tracing in isolation, I think it could have been managed a little differently. You know, don't just throw them under the bus. Be respectful is what I'm saying. Does that make sense to you, Avis?
Yes.
Okay. So that's the basic principle here. This is mostly a conversation on fetal heart rate tracings, how to distinguish a category 1 versus 2 versus 3 tracing, how to manage them, what constitutes intrauterine fetal resuscitation, and that's it. There's one other question they may ask you specific to this case now. By the way, if everything I've mentioned so far, folks, applies to everyone listening in. The point I'm going to mention now is only to a handful of you listening in. But the issue for duration, time duration, is relevant for everyone. How long did it take you from the time you made the diagnosis for C-section to actually get the head out?
I think that is like 35 or 37 minutes.
So that's a problem. And that's one reason. In fact, we need to discuss this a little more. I don't want to go into too much detail now because it's not relevant for everyone else to listen in. But I do want to – it's an interesting discussion, but I want to have it just with you. I'm going to ask you to get in touch with my office, give us your contact information, time zone that you're in, and what's a good time to reach out to you. And you and I will have a private conversation as to how to handle this. But the general point that I want to mention is, I speak and open to correction. This is for all of you. If your hospital is going to offer an obstetric service, I believe JHCAO. Required that you have to be able to do an emergency C-section within 30 minutes. So number one, don't mention 35 minutes. Say 25 or 30 minutes. No one's going to quibble with you over that. Okay? That's number one. Number two, we would like it to be quicker, especially if she's in the hospital already. She's got an IV line up because she would have received IV antibiotics for a chorioamnionitis. It should have been quicker. And because it's so long, if you're in a rural hospital, Avis, by the way, are you or not?
I'm not.
Okay, so I'm surprised because if you're in a... Say again?
Yeah, I'm in the urban area, like a metropolitan area.
Okay, I would have expected you folks to have been able to do the C-section quicker. But any time you've got a situation where an emergency C-section is required and you can't do the C-section get the baby out within the next half hour, a cord prolapse, for example, you, Avis, not necessarily other people listening in, but you, Avis, you need to be able to handle a question on the issues you need to keep in mind when doing a C-section under local anesthetic. And you can understand how that conversation can come up in this case, in this kind of a case. And don't panic. We know historically that 99% of you listening in are going to attend our definitive board prep course, okay? And that's later on in the year. It's not for now. But at that course, we're going to discuss with you what you need to know for a C-section under local anesthetic. So I don't want you to panic. And Avis, you need to know that definitely before you walk in the exam. But we've got you covered because I'm confident you probably will be one of the 99% who come to the course, and we'll discuss that at that time. But if you want to discuss anything further about this case, I'm happy to do that with you. But I don't want to waste other people's time because it's not relevant to them. It's really specific to you. And it's about the emergency C-section, why it took so long, etc. And also they may ask you the pros and cons of doing a midline intraumbilical incision versus a fan and steel in the case of an emergency C-section. Okay? So, Avis, we've discussed, we spent half an hour talking about one case, okay? And folks, if you think about it, outside of the suboptimal outcome, neonatal outcome, this really is a pretty standard, straightforward case. There's nothing too odd, unusual about it. But all of you, I'm hoping, have a better idea of how to put list your individual cases. Make sure that stuff that's not relevant to the case is removed. You don't bore your examiner with irrelevant stuff and have them think you don't know what's relevant versus irrelevant. And you want to construct it and word it in such a way that it's going to conjure up certain thoughts and certain curiosities in your examiner's mind. And they will respond by asking you questions, which invariably, if you do this properly, will be the kind of questions you're looking to get in the exam. So, Avis, does all of this make sense to you?
Yes, it makes a lot of sense to me so far.
Good, good. Do you have? I'm done with this case now. Do you have any questions you want to run by me on this case?
I think all those questions you suggested are very reasonable, and I really hope that they will ask these questions because it's relatively straightforward. Initially, I presented this case just because I'm really worried about they asked many questions on the poor baby outcome or focus
yes.
on like the movement. So, but I think I really like that you suggested upon like assuming patient's care to do the C-section, that part. So I hope
yeah.
that will kind of defend myself like for not like managing this case poorly for the baby outcome.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. And by the way, there's one other thing I forgot to mention. There was a ACOG committee opinion probably about 10 years ago. It was entitled APGAR score, or just APGAR. And in that,
there will be policy, like how to make the diagnosis for the neonatal encephalopathy, like the HIE, like the.
Yes, there have been a few publications in that regard. But the point that I want to make, and it is relevant for the majority of people listening in, I think it says in that publication, when you get an APGAR score of 5, I think it's 5 or less, to give a 5-minute, if the 5-minute APGAR score is 5 or less, you've got to give a 10-minute APGAR score, which you did, okay? If you continue giving additional 5-minute interval APGARs until the APGAR goes above 6 and above. And so ideally, if you can, it'll be nice at a minimum to say the APGAR finally went up after 15 minutes or 20 minutes. You don't have to know all the exact numbers, but show the examiner that when you get a really poor APGAR, there's an obligation to continue monitoring APGAR, okay, every 5 minutes
okay.
until it comes up. All right. So listen, Avis, we are done. I'm going to ask you to share with everyone listening in. Be honest. Did you find this was helpful? Did you find it terrifying, or was it okay? Share with everyone listening in your experience. Avis,
no,
hello,
Oh, I'm still here. Yes, I appreciate the discussions, and then I feel like this discussion is really helpful. And I don't really feel scared. I think it's just like a share of my case, and we'll get like a very good feedback from you. So I appreciate your help here.
Would you advise your colleagues to do what you did this week and volunteer to be on the hot seat, or no?
Yes, of course. I actually feel sad that no one, so far not many people are interested in volunteering. I'm glad that I just submitted like 2 hours ago, and I thanks for Karina for your help to coordinate, and then I can get this like to this hotspot.
Good, 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 good. So, folks, the reason why I asked Avis this is because, you know, we're going to do the next one in 2 weeks' time now. But I want you to volunteer because, A, it's good for you folks to have the experience of being on the hot seat. And it's good for everyone listening in, and it's also good for me because I can the discussion becomes so much more practical and real if we can discuss actual cases, and you get I can give you so much more if there's an actual case we can discuss. And like I said, this case was really a very benign, or not benign, a pretty bland case. But look how much we got out of it. And you can do this very easily. So please, folks, bottom line, volunteer to be on the hot seat. It's really, really very highly recommended. I can't emphasize that a lot. So with that being said, Avis, thank you so much. To everyone listening in, thank you so much. Our next teleseminar will be on the 6th of April, which is 2 weeks from today, the 6th of April. And we'll do this all again. Please volunteer and submit cases of interest. Thanks so much, Avis. Thanks, everyone else. All the best. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.